Hey, you're listening to Block Thinking with Werner Puchert.
So before we dive into this week's episode of Block Thinking, I've got a few announcements to make. As you might know, Jonathan is taking a break from the show. We covered that whole topic and why Jonathan is taking a break in a small mini episode that we released last week. Go check that out. We wish Jonathan all the best. Second thing is, this week I'm joined by a special co-host and former guest of Block Thinking, Aga Shostek. The reason Aga is joining me is that myself and Aga are working on another project called Catching the Next Wave. In this podcast, we're specifically focusing on transformational experience design. We are releasing the full season of interviews around the 5th of September. I'll post a link to the show in the show notes, but you'll find it under Catching the Next Wave on iTunes. Then, as part of the Next Wave initiative, we also interviewed Jerrica Cleland, formerly from Pixar. Now, Jerrica is a filmmaker, teacher, storyteller, director, and she's going to be in Warsaw, Poland sometime in September to host a narrative and storytelling workshop. And if this tweaks your interest, I'm going to post a link to that workshop in our show notes, and we still have space, so if you're keen to join us, if you're interested in this workshop, reach out to myself or Aga, and we'll see how we can hook you up. I hope to see you guys there. Now let's get back to Block Thinking. This week, we speak to a former interaction designer from Cooper in San Francisco. Why former? My friend Seth Murnard swapped San Francisco for Warsaw, Poland. Why, you may ask? We hope to answer that question and a few others during the course of the show. However, I'll add this. Now, one of the reasons that I was personally very excited to speak to Seth is the fact that he's been focusing on redesigning his own life. Now, this aligns with the premise that I've had and that I'm trying to employ in my life, is the fact that if you really want to design impactful, meaningful, transformational experiences for people, you need to transform yourself. And I think Seth is a great example of this. I think if you listen to the show, you might gather some insights from what he has to say. So without further ado, here is Aga to introduce Seth.
Seth used to be an interaction designer at Cooper for how many years?
2 years.
He's the guy who loves unpacking problems at their core and exploring not so obvious directions for them. His way of thinking is pretty unique. He likes the domain of finances. And he likes to use a user-centric approach to financial planning tools. And before Cooper, Seth worked as a senior experience designer at MedPow and then a product designer at Indiegogo. And quite recently, he decided to redesign his own life, quit his job, move across the world to reinvent himself as a designer.
And the reason we're talking to you is that we couldn't help observing your activities. And of course, now the question comes up, before you design for other people, you probably have to think about how you design yourself.
I have lots of thoughts about this. It's interesting because like you're talking about design. And I think when people think of design, they think of creating something outside of themselves in order to help themselves or help another person. And a lot of people are obsessed with digital things right now, apps and all this stuff. Or you could think about it like a gadget, a physical object. And through this recent trajectory of quitting my job, selling 90% of my belongings, and minimalizing my to-dos in the everyday world, all that stuff, what I am focused on is actually not the design of like things outside of me, but the things within me, if that makes sense. So, and I think that's actually a lot more useful to go, okay, how can I have confidence in this situation? And the idea of confidence being a valuable thing, and the idea of having confidence in situations where it's not some object giving me that or something outside of me, but it's like actually within me, is a lot more useful than, okay, I'm trying to think of a good example, like, oh, this app will help me do this and that, and then therefore I'll be more confident in this situation. Through the minimalism, it's like, it's kind of counterintuitive when you think about design, because usually when you think about design, you think about actually creating things and more
adding.
More stuff. But when I'm thinking about it, it's more about transforming myself in a way that I want to, and it doesn't rely on things outside of me. Well, I think right now, so I'll take an an easy example, which is like body things. Like for sure, I've had my own like ideal version of myself and my body and how, oh, wouldn't it be great if I had no like injuries in my body and I could just do anything I wanted to and run everywhere and rock climb and do all these crazy things with my body and I looked really fit. And I'm seeing people on Instagram or social media or just like my friends in person with that are able to do these things. And I can, there's like the reality of myself, and then there's these examples, these models around me of what's possible. And so then it's like, oh man, how do I transform to that? Like I have this desire. And I think some people think it's like, okay, I'll sign up for this like boot camp that will get me into shape, or I'll start dieting and do this and that will get me into shape, and or I'll buy this like exercise equipment and that will do the trick. And for me, my trajectory with that has been more like just not actual outside things have helped me with that. One is just being content with my body and how it is, which doesn't involve anything like outside. It's just like my own kind of like self-compassion and doing like self-compassion work and meditation to actually try to go towards that direction. And two is like just trying to like develop healthy habits and give a shit enough to actually do those healthy habits, where it's like, yeah, I don't really feel like doing yoga right now, but I know I'll feel better once I start being active in this way. And these will help these like chronic injuries I have and all that. So it's much more about like my head and like the psychology of myself, trying to like know what tricks, what little things can trick me into doing things in order to get there, rather than like, oh, well, I'll buy rock climbing equipment with the promise that I'll take on this rock climbing hobby. And then all of a sudden, 4 years later, that's like a part of the stuff that I'm selling with the 90% of my stuff that I'm getting rid of because I just don't use it anymore.
Those little artifacts that you cling to, right? Because you think, if I buy the different stuff, like a whole bunch of microphones, like someone in this room, the act of creation is going to happen, but it isn't. Mm-hmm. It actually starts with the self.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, so I've been trying to flip my attitude around that in general, which is like this borrow, rent, buy, rather than buy first. So it's like, okay, if I'm doing a thing so much, if I'm running podcasts or if I'm, let's say, I'm rock climbing so much that I'm having to borrow my friend's equipment in a way that is like, it's a pain to do so. Okay, then maybe I should rent or maybe I should buy at that point. But there's like a justification for it. It's actually makes sense for me to purchase this because it's costing me more money to be renting it all the time, rather than going, okay, I want to adopt this hobby, so right off the bat, I'm going to buy this thing. Also, you have the perspective of knowing what you want more if you've tried it out so many times and you're borrowing of like, oh, this is actually the right thing for me. So from like going back to like the whole design theme, to me, that's rapid prototyping.
Exactly.
And starting it in like a low investment, low energy type of way. Oh, let me just try this out a little bit, rather than fantasizing, oh, wouldn't it be great if I was a rock climber? Well, these rock climbers, they have this and that, and they do these things. So I'm gonna buy those things. I'm gonna book the trip to Yosemite, the crazy rock climbing place, and like just role play this rock climber, and then I'll find out that, oh wait, I'm actually not that into this. Where I could have just climbed a tree and decided like, whoa, I'm actually really afraid of heights.
Exactly. And then and also doing that other route, you lead yourself or set yourself up potentially for deep disappointment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Because you're comparing from this ideal and looking backwards or down upon yourself and where you're at, rather than looking at where you're at and going, oh, look what I'm doing now, and being like grateful for the fact that you're able to climb a tree, rather than being like, man, why am I not like this crazy rock climber in Yosemite?
There is this distinction that we discussed. Design can be used for, and typically is used for, designing objects, you know, virtual or physical, mm-hmm. But actually there is a potential for switching for designing solutions to change attitude and behavior. Mm. And this is a certain shift at least in my perception, from this perspective of 20th centuries, like industrial design approach of like, you know, we have to pump up consumerism as a way of living, and going into thinking about using design as a way to increase the well-being of people. You know, like right now I can see with lots of my students that they that they do have a lot of trouble with like the depression and, you know, like all these kind of issues. And obviously this is becoming one of the major problems for our civilization. And, you know, like when you said about Instagram and about Facebook and all the other social media who are showing this images of ideal people, like those people who you can aspire to, but you can't really be. Can design be used for evil?
Yeah. One quote that sticks in my mind, I forget who said it, some futurist that thinks about these things all the time, said technology is technology is inevitable, but how we use it is not. Of course, with being a human in our human conditions, things like Uber, where it makes transporting our bodies around this world that we live in easier, is like an inevitable technology, or autonomous vehicles and things like that. These are all kind of like, yeah, of course that would naturally happen because we're humans and we want to move around and this makes it easy to do that. But then how we use those technologies is kind of up to us. So I think that's kind of the same. You could think of design as this like powerful tool that we've been developing over time, this, you know, I guess technology in a way, but it's a methodology, and it's really, really powerful how we mix psychology and understanding of people and what triggers them and how to work with their motivations and their goals to lead them along different paths. And you can have those paths be for their goals and actually be supporting them and helping them out. Or you could have those paths be tricking them into thinking, yes, this is good for you, but it's actually more for your goals as a company. For sure, design can be used for evil. This is, and at Cooper, we talked about this a lot, actually, and Alan Cooper is really into these ideas and these questions. And there's, I think it's Eames has these 10 principles of design, I think it is.
Dieter Rahm.
Mm-hmm. And so his whole thing is like, there's a missing principle, which should be something around ethics. And there's no ethics in those principles. That's true. Ethics aren't actually being taught necessarily at design school. And it's like, okay, over the 20 years, design has gone through, as a profession, has gone through so much transformation, has so much respect. It now has a seat at the table. And now is actually the time to start leveraging that seat at the table to steer things in a good ethical direction. And one of the biggest decisions you have as a designer ethically is who you design for. And what are you designing in the first place? Do you take a job for a nonprofit that's trying to help, you know, hungry children in Africa? Or do you take a job for Facebook that's trying to get people addicted to staring at screens so they can put advertisements in front of you?
And I think that's sometimes hard to spot, right? Because also what happens is that the word design, people see it as an act of building something for customers. But while you were talking, for example, and using the Uber context, and I hate using Uber because if I go to a presentation, everybody uses Uber, right? But I'm going to have to go for it. But you used Uber. So the design of getting persons from point A to point B, okay, that's a cool idea. That helps. That's a great design, right? But then when you look at the revenue that some of the drivers are getting out of it, like what is that really? Then there were some issues recently where they had problems with internally with staff and how female staff were treated. Those systems, so the revenue that the drivers were getting, that was designed. Maybe not intentionally, but it's a designed act. How you treat your staff is designed. And I think some people don't understand that they themselves are actually designers and they're designing stuff for companies, and you need to take ownership of it because it's not, you need to own it. And I think to latch on what you're saying is like, you need to understand what you're doing and you need to take ownership of what it is you're doing, and does it align with your personal and, you know, benchmarks?
Values.
Totally. That's the word.
Yeah, that's interesting. I love that idea of everyone is a designer. Everyone makes design decisions, because to me, design is just intentional decision making. I want to achieve this. Therefore, I do these things or I make these decisions in order to achieve that. So everyone is doing those things.
I mean, there was a brilliant talk that I attended recently with Mike Monterio, and he spoke about what happened in the US elections, right? So, I mean, there's a lot of debate going on. I don't want to go into down the politics, but he spoke into a lot of the things that happened. I mean, if you look at Cambridge Analytica, someone designed what happened there, right? Someone designed the Facebook activity that happened on Facebook. You know, we always think it's like these secret little Russian guys hiding behind, but there's designers behind these things happening. And I don't think people realize, right?
Yeah, so if there's designers behind these things, or if there's design happening, that means there's intention happening. And so then it's like, who is being held accountable for that intention? And I think a lot of times in these it's easy to say, well, it's not actually, I work for this company, but it's not my intention. I'm just working for this company's intention. But if you're helping out, that is your intention. Yeah. But some
it becomes
reason,
your intention.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But people, I think it's easy for us. We have this culture of being like, no, but I'm just working for them. I'm just, you know, I'm a good person. Yeah. I'm trying to do these good things. And it's easy to separate yourself from the intention of the company.
I'm listening to you and I'm thinking that your decision to adopt the nomadic life, this is something that, so like we are all so entangled in everything that we possess. Yeah. And how do you get to the decision to, you know, detach from all those belongings, and how does it impact your way of thinking of the value of design and the ethics of design?
I think it's going back to this idea of rapid prototyping. Like, things don't just happen overnight. All of a sudden you're totally changed. I think one of my biggest hobbies is backpacking. So having all my stuff in a backpack where I can go out in the wilderness and camp and do that for multiple days. And this is just a hobby that developed over time in California. There's beautiful places to do this. And a lot of it was to escape the city because I've never lived in a city before. And through that, you have to be minimalist. You have to question every object you're bringing because you don't want to hike it around for 30 miles and, you know, it's every little ounce matters. So you're really being conscious of everything that you're bringing, whether or not you need it. And over time, I was getting more and more minimalist to the point where one time I hardly brought a tent, which was a little bit on accident. I was trying to do this thing where you only need the rain fly, the cover of the tent. You don't actually need the inside tent part, but I forgot some components where I had to jerry rig something. And I actually surprised myself because it was like, holy crap, I forgot the majority of my tent, but I was still able to make a tent-like contraption and totally survive. I mean, it was really cold. It was like freezing temperatures at night and survive and figure it out. And it really showed me I don't even need that. Like, there's very few things I need in order to survive and accomplish what I'm trying to accomplish here. So it was kind of it felt very empowering to go through that experience. And because I was legitimately scared at one point and thought I would have to hike 17 miles back in order to survive rather than stay there that night. And so through that backpacking and really experimenting with minimalizing and questioning what I need, what physical objects I need, I think it allowed me to have this mindset where it's just really able to question, oh wait, do you actually need that? Or can you, so I actually obsess about this. Like in the kitchen, I find this really interesting where you have a specific gadget for every little thing you would want to do. Okay, here's this thing that does, peels garlic, and this other thing that does this to an onion. And all of a sudden you have a kitchen full of crap.
Exactly.
And all you really need is a knife.
Yeah.
And so just having that mindset and changing I just need one tool that does a million things rather than a million tools that
for
do one thing.
Yeah.
So having that mindset with backpacking then allowed me to, I think, apply it to my life as whole. Is what do I really need? And actually getting rid of my stuff was, you know, I had this motivation of leading this nomadic life and moving abroad and living. I've been fantasizing this for a while. And then this opportunity came where I fell in love with Magda at a castle where I met all of you guys as well. Yeah. And I was like, you know, I'm just going to make this happen and move to Poland. But it wasn't that crazy in my mind. I think it was crazy for everyone else, but yeah. I had already gone through these like internal transformations of like, oh, I can totally quit my job. I can totally like get rid of my stuff and just go abroad and live there. I was kind of like mentally prepared for this. So,
it was more a physical act rather than a mental at that stage.
Yeah, it was almost I didn't have a choice at that stage. It was... Yeah, I didn't really feel like I had a choice. It was, okay, I'm falling in love. I want to continue falling in love. This is pretty nice. you know, like, I don't want to get in the way of this happening. And right now, physical location is the biggest barrier. So I'm just going to, you know, I have the means to do so. So I'm going to make that happen. But it was like, I didn't really question it. It was kind of, yeah, of course I would do this. Because yeah, but- I already was kind of prepared to do that. I mean, I think it would be different if I was already kind of lifting roots from San Francisco yeah. at that point of time. So it worked out.
Those barriers that you talk about is barriers that you set for yourself. It's not actual barriers.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was just thinking that you both had this experience of leaving your home and moving to Poland. But I can imagine that you both had different approaches to that, which is extremely curious because like what you were saying is...
Werner and I had that.
Yeah. And so I can imagine that there's one way of collecting your stuff and shipping it over here. And there's a different way like mm-hmm. you did. Okay, how about
start afresh
and see what's going to happen?
All that was happening at once. Okay, I'm going to quit the place I was living. I lived in a beautiful rent-controlled spot in San Francisco, which is like the equivalent of owning a house. It's like an asset to have a rent-controlled apartment there. Quit my job that was, you know, working for this well-known design agency, working on really cool projects. And in a way, I wanted to totally reset everything, where I lived, what I did for work, all the physical objects. I wanted to kind of like let go of everything and give myself total freedom and then question everything, but also be curious and be open to everything, knowing that whatever happens out of that will be very deliberate. It won't be because it's comfortable. It's what I've been doing the whole time. Or, well, I have these objects and, you know, of course I'm going to do them this way. It's like, oh, I have absolutely nothing. Now what am I going to do? And it's kind of the equivalent of like, I feel for me at least, I was getting in these habitual loops so much. I was actually creating like this physical groove, you know, and it like I was getting deep into this groove because of these habits I was having that it was very difficult for me to get out of them. So what I wanted to do is get rid of all the grooves, just have totally flat. So there was like no anchors, I guess, in a way. And then just like allow myself to surprise myself. Funny thing is, you would think this would be easy, but like I have to actively be reminding myself, oh shit, I'm getting into another groove again. And okay, remember, this is like the time of being curious and exploration, being jobless in a foreign country with a, you know, new girlfriend and new people around me and all these things. Like, very easy to have these grooves again in order to be comfortable. And I have to remind myself, like, discomfort's okay, and to continue to be like,
I love it,
curious and open.
Just to dip into something that's quite practical. So recently on social media, you posted a message, because I know of other people who've also moved to Central Europe. And I think you've done more in a few weeks in Poland than a lot of people who are expats. So you're doing some yoga. There's some other stuff that you were talking about. Can you share some of the things that you've unlocked and just opened yourself to happening? Because I know there's a few stories behind it. Tell a story.
Okay. Yeah, I have a few stories, I guess. So I'm resetting my life, right? Yeah. And so from that perspective of like blank canvas, then I can really go, okay, what do I want to be doing? How do I want to be spending my energy, basically? And for me, a lot of it is building what I would look at as like healthy habits. And some of those healthy habits for me are playing my ukulele, because it's like this meditation that I put myself in, and it's this new hobby of mine where I'm getting better over time and seeing that progress, and it's a lot of fun, and I want to get to the point where I can actually play in a social setting and people aren't asking me to stop playing. So it's like play the ukulele, meditate, and do yoga. Kind of similar. Yoga is definitely more for my body. I actually have a lot of like chronic back problems and shoulder problems that get in the way of me doing physical activity. So yoga has been really helpful, and I know that. So I wanted to, I have no job. It's like I could be doing yoga every day. Mm-hmm. And then the third is actually practicing improv, and knowing that that is like this really healthy thing for me in my relationships with other people and for my job, being able to actively listen to what other people are saying and go with it and support it and use, you know, classic yes and techniques rather than just having this voice that tries to like compete and trump what other people are saying and not really listening to other people. So knowing that's actually a really healthy practice for me is improv techniques. And I've done this in San Francisco as well. So then I'm in Poland and I don't know Polish, and I'm trying to figure out how to have these healthy habits. And Polish is not like an expat destination per se.
Not yet.
Not yet. It's like the place people in Poland go to have jobs and live. But you know, it's not like, oh yeah, I'm gonna go to Warsaw and develop a new life. So it wasn't like readily available. There wasn't just like one website where it's like, okay, here's your English speaking yoga and meditation and ukulele players and improv. And I knew that I needed community because I'm jobless. And I have my girlfriend and I have her friends, but it's tough to create community here. And that's like the biggest depressing thing is having lack of community for anyone, anywhere. So I knew I needed to establish that. So it was crazy. I like for the ukulele thing, I found some music school in Warsaw that does classes in English, and I saw that they do ukulele classes and it had the teacher and everything. I contacted them. They said, no, we don't offer ukulele classes anymore. So then I was a creeper and went on Facebook, took her name because her name is still on the website, found her on Facebook. Cold messaged her on Facebook, and she actually responded and got it. And then find out that there's actually a 6,000 person Facebook group of ukulele players in Poland. And there's a huge contingent in Warsaw, and they just like meet up and do jam sessions every and then. And so I...
We should go as audience.
Exactly.
We were talking about doing one outside because now it's nice weather. They do them in the summertime outside all the time. Do one in a couple hours because it's nice weather right now. But so then somehow get her to coordinate this like meetup using this Facebook group to have like five people meet up at this really cool like bar venue place to jam out inside because it was actually cold out. And then I'm meeting five people that play the ukulele and just like to jam together because I randomly messaged this person. And it totally worked out. Now I'm a part of this community and I have access to these people and they have this shared interest. In San Francisco, I never did anything like that because I had so much access. I had community and I had these grooves and I was comfortable, where here, like any social interaction, I have gratitude for. The fact that I talked to my Uber driver today felt so good because it was like, oh, a new person. I'm like so thirsty for it. So like the reward of trying to make these things happen is greater. So I'm actually creating more of a life that is aligned with what I want to be doing here than I was in San Francisco, because these comforts and these grooves and this, oh, I have so much access while I don't actually need to do anything, was keeping me back, where here I actually have to create it somehow.
It's keeping you back and also feels like it's isolating yourself and you don't realize it.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
you're so locked in your own world, you forget about these things. Because even for myself and Marta driving to the recording, we were seeing things happening in Warsaw and going like, wow, this is happening. This is happening. I mean, we've been in winter mode and then you all of a sudden see all these magical things happening around you. This whole experience is kind of unlocking and you have to be open for those things.
Totally.
The Block Thinking Podcast is brought to you with the support of Seed Cards, an inspirational creative tool for experience design. About 80% of companies worldwide think they are customer-centric. Only 8% of their customers agree. Get inspired by the best customer experiences from leading brands such as Disney, Netflix, and Southwest Airlines. Seed Cards will challenge you and your team to break with convention. They will encourage you to develop ideas that will resonate with your customers in a meaningful way. Visit www.seedcards.com or www.seedcards.pl to download a free sample. Get inspired to create unique experiences for your customers.
So hey guys, we've got a special offer for you. For listeners of the Block Thinking Podcast, we have a special 10% discount on the Polish and English versions of Seed Cards. All you have to do is go to kajetatrenera.pl and use the promo code BLOCKTHINKING, that is B-L-O-C space thinking, and you'll get 10% discount on your purchase. Now, let's get back to the show.
When you were talking before, you were talking about this whole issue for designers being responsible for the stuff they're designing. Mm-hmm. And there's one issue or more a struggle that I'm struggling myself. What's the story with designers and their egos?
Do you agree with that statement, maybe?
That's a big question.
It's a big podcast.
I don't think it helps if you want to collaborate with other people. If you want to be an artist that just like is in your own world and is creating something unique and different, and you actually might not care as much about like the audience or other people, you're just like producing, then maybe an ego would be helpful in order to like go crazy on that, you know, being able to ignore an ego is good for being able to ignore other people's opinions and kind of like maybe. Actually, now that I've said that, maybe not, because like you need to feed the ego as well. So you want that, like, yes, I am great, you know, that confirmation. I guess I'll go to my first thought, which is working at Cooper. Cooper does something called pair designing, which is kind of an intuitive concept where you're actually designing in a pair. You own the project together equally. There is no junior senior relationship.
Yeah.
It's okay. We're both equally responsible for this. We're only working on this one project at this one time for 3 months. So that project and that relationship with your partner is your life. You see that person more than your spouse. So in that situation, and then, you know, working with a client, working with the other people at the company and collaborating, there's a lot of collaboration involved. So in that situation, we actually hire for people that don't have an ego, or at least can turn control their ego down. And then we train for that as well. So, I mean, the classic thing is not falling in love with your ideas. And so you have this, in the pair designing relationship, you go into two modes, and usually one person specializes in one mode, which is generating, and then the other person specializes in the other mode, which is synthesizing. And so in generating, you're just creating, it's about volume. You're trying to create a lot of options, a lot of ideas. Oh, we could do this, we could do that. And it's exhaustive. You're actually not turning on that judge in that generation mode. That's when the judge is reserved for the synthesizing, when you're going, okay, is this actually useful? Does this help people? So in the generation mode, there's freedom in it, because you don't have to be the judge. You can just be free to create. Some people get a little bit uncomfortable with that, but the idea is You're just creating stuff. You're not in love with your ideas. You're just creating all these options. But then once you go into synthesizing mode, you can't have any babies in the, you're like, no, but this is my love. Precious. I love this. Yeah.
My precious.
Yes. Yeah. My precious idea. I think this is going to be the most successful. Then you have this partner that's kind of saying, but, oh, this is, you know, they have this totally different perspective. And if you have an ego in that conflict that naturally arises, then it can turn sour really quickly. And you're actually not letting the conflict happen because you're just kind of standing up for your ego, and your motivations aren't for the user or for the client that you're trying to help. It's for you and your own ego. And so it pulls away. I think it gets in the way of you user-centered designers, because all of a sudden it's like then you become the artist that wants this, you want to release this thing into the world rather than actually helping people. And also in that pair relationship, your partner is going to not want to really interact with you as much. They might feel like you're just shooting down their ideas, or you're not really listening to their ideas. And that's this like fragile relationship. And really the value of that pair design partnership is in the conflict, or in the conversation, the back and forth conversation that happens when you're figuring these things out, and the design falls out of that conversation and that difference in perspectives kind of having friction with each other actually creates something that neither of you could have created individually, and is such better quality than something you could have created individually. So if you have an ego in that situation, it's as if, you know, if one person has a huge ego and the other person doesn't, then it's as if that one person just created something themselves. I was actually talking to Magda about it. The ego is such a motivating factor. Like, she really wants to produce good work, and she wants to be proud of what she produces. Totally understand that. We all want to be proud of what we create. And I think there is a little bit of ego in that motivation to be proud. So you can't just totally be egoless, right? Like you're a perfect like Buddhist monk. But I think it's helpful to be conscious of it and knowing when you might be turning that ego, or that ego is actually getting in your way, and being able to tone that down and kind of have that choice.
All right. So, you know, like we have this fashion in design these days, which is called design thinking. Mm-hmm.
I think it's great. It's like the Kleenex of design, and it has been a vehicle for people to communicate the design and what kind of what it is and the value and how it can be useful. And so great. Now, you know, it's helped design be a thing. And again, that whole idea of having a seat at the table, right?
Yeah.
Oh, you have engineering, or you have marketing, and you have design now, where before it was much more secondary. So it's totally helped in that battle. But now I think it's almost, it's tough. I think it's a lot of the principles of design thinking are great. They're actually great for anybody in any situation, whether it's your life or professionally, but it's not the end. It's not the end all be all. Yeah. And there's other tools and there's other ways of thinking. I think a lot of people think, oh, we just need to do this design thinking thing and we'll be fine as a company.
A recipe.
Yeah.
Success.
Yeah. And so working at Cooper, I'll give a little bit of history. Cooper started in like the early 90s, Silicon Valley, doing their thing, coming up with their methodologies and creating things like personas and all these tools and methodologies that people actually started using. And they had their own kind of brand of design, which was goal-directed design. So it's all about if you meet users' goals and you meet organization or business goals, then you win, because the business is happy, the users are happy. That's like the secret sauce, and you need to really understand both in order to come up with a good design. And so, from that perspective, with Cooper, it's it's been tough because we compete with IDEO, and design thinking is, I think, for a lot of people, is very closely tied with Stanford and IDEO. And the IDEO guys, they do that. They invented that. Let's hire them. And so sometimes we have to compete with the Kleenex of design, and kind of, you know, we have this like David versus a Goliath kind of attitude about it with design thinking. It's like, oh no, we do that as well. And in recently we've had to sell design thinking and use that terminology and kind of just swallow again the whole ego thing. The consultancy kind of swallowing their own ego and being like, this is the language people are using. We can fill in, so it's a vehicle, we can fill in that vehicle in our own way. We don't have to do it in the purely IDEO way. We can still have our own signature on it. But I think it's more or less like it's a conversation piece that then can get into, I hope, get into a larger conversation rather than being something almost limiting and being like, oh, design thinking or design is only design thinking, which is only these things.
And that's super limiting to think about in that way. We need to be exploring all different kinds of things and looking, question your own paradigms, right?
Mm-hmm. And be experimenting. Yeah. You know, it's not like design thinking and all these methodologies came out of experimenting. Oh, what happens when we approach these things? That won't stop. It will just keep on continuing. So, you know, to just hold on to one concept could actually hold you back from experimenting with new.
We had a stone soup experience last night.
Mm-hmm.
My wife was disappointed. It wasn't stone soup.
This is very Polish of her.
It's like, where's the soup? But it's
curry
a it's
doesn't
a
count as a soup.
Yeah.
Curry's not the soup, Seth. I love the concept. I think we tasted a small prototype of this. Tell us more.
So the story of stone soup is the idea that these strangers make a soup together by a couple of the strangers getting a pot of water and putting a rock into it and then going around to the other, you know, strangers, to their homes, their neighborhood, right? And saying, hey, we're making a soup for everyone. Would you like to add to it? So they're actually tricking people in the beginning. But then more and more people see, oh, this guy's added carrots. That guy's added this. Cool. I'm going to make this soup. And it's a soup that feeds everyone. So somebody that is starving can start a stone soup because stones are everywhere. So basically it is that idea, but for experiences. And we're all starving for experiences, but we all have the ability to facilitate experiences for each other, and we do this. Everyone has this ability. Everyone's an experienced designer and facilitator, whether they know it or not. And so the idea is basically that the stone you could look at as an intention. I have this intention to do this thing, this activity. Would you guys like to add to it? Would you guys like to participate in it? So stone soup itself is the invitation, I guess would be a better word. The invitation to, hey, let's all add to this. This was a night event. So let's all add to this dinner party, but not bringing food, but actually an activity to facilitate, an experience to facilitate. My stone soup was the event itself. And then you guys all created your own stone soup with the activities that you led. My grand vision is that, you know, instead of people going, hey, let's have a dinner party, it's let's have a stone soup where people get together and they're creating experiences for each other. And it's easy and simple. I also have visions of bigger events like I did in California, where we rented out a working farm in California for a three-day weekend. And there's 35 of us that did the first like stone soup, I guess, retreat or unconference, where the whole conference itself was created by the participants and each activity was then created by the participants, some planned beforehand, some kind of on the fly improvisation. So I have dreams of, you know, wouldn't it be great to just spread that concept that we can all create experiences for each other and we can experiment with that, because it's such a great venue for somebody like AGA that facilitates things all the time to be like, oh, wait, I could actually try this out here and I'm not going to get fired by the client. Very specifically useful for people like AGA, but also specific or useful for, you know, yoga teachers that want to do something different, but don't want to take the risk of doing it in their class and disappointing people.
So, or cooks.
Yeah. Or cooks. Like,
can you maybe share some of the experiences you've encountered? Like maybe one of
them was actually a really beautiful kind of almost set it and forget it type of experience at the retreat where these guys took over a closet in the farmhouse we were at and set up this whole thing. So I was walking around and I was blindfolded and then I was led to this space. I didn't know where I was going, but it was this closet they had set up and I was sat down very gently. It wasn't, you know, there was consent involved. sat down and blindfold was taken off and the door was shut. So all of a sudden I was sitting down in this closet alone and what was in front of me were these like candles, this very like intimate setup. It was very like soft and there was this notebook in front of me that said something like open me, and I open it and the first page is one instruction. This book is to do this. And then it said, flip the next page, and you flip the next page. And it's basically walking me through this activity where I had to write something to somebody that I really was appreciative for something they had done or was really grateful.
It's like gratitude journal.
Yeah. And so then it facilitated this whole activity without a person involved. I actually didn't see any person because I was blindfolded. And then so I went through this whole thing where I actually wrote something for Magda saying how grateful I was for her kind of being like a teacher in my life and having her in my life. So I wrote this whole thing. And then the last page in the instruction is to put it in this envelope and then walk out of the closet, take the blindfold and bring somebody to that closet. So it's self-perpetuating,
nice,
kind of passive experience, but it's secretive. So a lot of people actually didn't experience this and didn't know it existed because it was hidden and it was kind of happening secretly with random people getting blindfolded and led to it. So that was the guys that created that. That was their first time creating that, and they were kind of experimenting with it just to see if it would work. And you know, at some points in time, you know, the next person didn't blindfold somebody, and so it would kind of stop, and so they would tweak it kind of in the moment. Yeah. But all of that was available to experiment kind of on the fly and just figure it out over time. So
I mean, when I listen to the story, right, and you don't focus, I mean, I don't focus on the actual physical activities you describe, but I try and think about the construct of what just happened in that mm-hmm. designing of that process, but then also the emotion or the transformation that it kind of explores. If a bunch of guys get together somewhere and can design something like that, it's so powerful. Why can't we bring this into our day-to-day lives?
Exactly. And I have actually been doing that a little bit with actually my relationship with Magda, seeing a need for us to have kind of more deep, intimate time. We, you know, she's like busy with her work things and finishing her job that she just quit. And me kind of seeing this need and go, wait, Seth, I'm an experienced designer. I can articulate people and what their goals are and then design experiences for them and their goals. So I actually went through like a typical design process with articulating her goals and her motivations and then created an experience for her, like a surprise experience when she got home that night, that allowed us to do this whole thing where we were like, we co-painted a memory from our past that we shared and then shared memories that were before we knew each other that kind of had to do with that, but we had to act it out and had the other person guess. And then it ended in us creating a future memory that doesn't exist yet that relates to all of those things in this like fun game way where you have to like, you say three words and then the other person says the next three words. You're kind of co-creating this story. And it was all of, like, very like sensory and symbolic in, but very much around like memories and kind of like understanding more her and her past and my past and having this really intimate thing. And it was like awesome and it worked. And it took me like half an hour to create the concept for this. It was so quick. And it was so like, it just took a little bit of intention and in time in order to do that.
The beautiful thing that you just said is that there is intentionality which is necessary for us as designers, but also like as people, to bring this vision of experiences in our lives to life. So like without intention, we are sort of going back to the old ways over and over and
kind
over.
Kind of repeating those habit loops
exactly.
In a way, yeah.
And then I'll kind of loop to the first thing that I mentioned during this podcast, that in the end, perhaps this is really about changing behavior and attitude rather than designing things.
Well said, Aga.
And now it's time for Block Thinking Must-Haves.
All right. So just wrapping up with our final questions. And if you were to say what your mission statement or your strongest point is, what would it be?
It's tough because like I want to say something, but I really haven't done a lot of action to go toward this point. So
because this is commitment when you say it.
False. Yeah. It's like intimidating. I think I'll use this one because it's very specific. I think I'm scared about the earth and the environment. And I think the most useful thing we can do for the environment is get children outside and have a healthy relationship with the environment. So anything that is in support of that, I think is a really, really worthwhile mission. And right now I'm mostly just, being a fan of some friends that are actually doing this in San Francisco specifically, where they take like, teenage men into the environment to kind of like build this relationship with it. So I think a kid that loves the environment is less likely to destroy it when they have the power to do so as an adult.
Makes sense. Seth, this was brilliant. We've met before a long time ago at a weird castle.
The Chocolate Castle.
The castle of the College of Extraordinary Experiences. Check that out. But I just want to thank you. I've been looking at what you're doing. For you, you are very inspirational to me. I need to get across some of my barriers and follow in your footsteps. I think that's a good thing to do. And then also, I want to wish you the best for your next adventures because some good stuff coming up. And I think it was very apt to sit with you in this very sunny room in Poland. And I hear the birds chirping and I hear some nature coming into the recording. And I hope it remains in the recording because it kind of defines a conversation with Seth. So, dude, all the best and thank you for spending time.
See you next time.
Thank you, guys.
Hear you next time. Thanks, Seth.
Thanks for listening to Block Thinking. You can find more information and the show notes for this episode at www.blockthinking.com. That is blockthinking without the K.com. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe on iTunes or any of your favorite podcast platforms. We thrive on critique, so feel free to leave comments on iTunes or get hold of us directly. Thanks for listening.
Do you need random sound bites? Like
always.
I'm gonna have to like think about this one.
Aga. Werner.
We'll use that as a theme song.
Yeah, we should.
And I'm gonna switch it off.